Well, tonight is the 5th of April, and this is our 23rd session. As a result of the partition line that was agreed upon in the island of Rhodes, the Israelis moved right up to that line, and the villagers, whom we have just mentioned, were cut off from the lands which they used to till and which were their principal source of livelihood. And in many cases, these villagers were cut off from practically their only water supply, their only source of drinking water, either of wells or of springs, which were on the other side of the line. They were told that this was a temporary measure, but what was supposed to be temporary continued for until the time that we got interested in them, till 1955. By that time, we had heard, and the world had heard also, that these villagers cross the barbed wire at night. Their girls, their womenfolk, would cross the barbed wire at night carrying their water skins or jars to fill them from what they still consider to be theirs, the springs and the wells in Israel. For fear of being molested, their menfolk would remain on this side of the line to see that they are protected from any interference on the other side. Off and on, they would be seen and would be by the Israeli gendarmes and army and would be greeted in a very friendly way. And good luck to you girls, and go with your water and all the rest of it. But there were occasions, perhaps once or twice a year, when the Israelis would shoot at the girls to prevent them coming in. Sometimes they would be wounded, or some of them might be killed even, and they would be shooting back from the Arab side. And within a short while, the United Nations observers would come and would get the wounded or dead back, would try and mediate between both sides. But it was always within a few hours after such an incident that a case would be brought before the Security Council by the Israeli authorities of a case that the Arabs of Jordan have done an act of aggression on Israel by these women going across. And in all the history of the Security Council, to whom these appeals or these complaints by the Israeli authorities came, after weeks of deliberation and hearing statements and hearing evidence, the Security Council would normally come out with a resolution to the following effect. They would say, this is a sad case of a girl who has been killed or wounded while she and her companions were attempting to haul water for their village. We appeal to the good nature of Israel to tell her soldiers, if these girls ever cross, not to shoot them again. At the same time, we appeal to the Jordan authorities to prevent these girls from crossing and thereby save them from being killed. In full stop, that was all. There was never any suggestion by the Security Council that alternative water supply should be found. That would be a better prevention than a military preventing the girls from crossing. Nobody ever thought of quenching the thirst of these villages. At the same time, that was one of their problems. At the same time, these villages were situated in what was considered by the Jordanian authorities as a military zone. And so access to them, and access, ingress and egress out of them, was controlled, which meant that they couldn't work elsewhere and come back at night to their village. It meant that no visitor could come and see their plight and thereby perhaps be the cause of some help coming to them. And they were really the living dead. Eventually, when our society operated there, the first thing that we wanted to find out, how was it that for 7 years before we had been there, how was it that these people were able to survive? That was the great question which neither we nor any of our friends could find out. And then, and very, very little, and very slowly, it was dawned upon us that the only reason that kept them really from complete disaster was the fact that their young men, 17, 18, 16, would secretly escape from the village and secretly cross frontiers and secretly cross the desert until they will get to either Saudi Arabia or the Persian Gulf area, and there find employment and after a while send a trickle of money to their parents in their villages. And we then eventually found out, it was disclosed by the Arab governments, that they had found that many of these lads crossing towards the east of the Arab Peninsula were killed on the way, or died on the way from thirst in the desert, and or else when some frontier control challenged them and they escaped, they were shot at, and because they had to cross several frontiers to get there. But that was the position, that at the risk of being killed, the men went out to get some money for their parents. At the risk of being killed, the girls went westward to get water, to fetch water for their village. And I and my colleagues in society did everything we could to get these facts known to as many Arabs as possible, to as many newspapermen from the West as possible, to as many people in official positions here and elsewhere. But we failed to make any dent or any impression on them. And I was fortunate that in 1955 I got the Ford Foundation representatives in the Middle East interested in what I was telling them. And they asked to go themselves and see things. And so Dr. Roland Eger and his colleague came and spent 3 days with me, going from village to village, from the north to the south, under the most difficult circumstances, because there were no roads running north-south. And there were only very few tracks going east-west. And the bumpy tracks and the miserable time we had on the road was only surpassed by our shock at the misery that we saw in each village. We saw people with drawn faces and bulging eyes. They were obviously leaders of their village. They would look intent at you and sort of with despise ask you, what have you come for? Why do you come after 7 years? We haven't seen any of you before. What has changed? What has taken place? We don't want you. Actually, we were turned out of these villages, one after the other, in many cases. Not only when I went with the Ford Foundation, but in particular, eventually, when I went with the officer commanding the Jordanian army in the West Bank, when he was ordered by the king, who was very, very much interested in what I had told him, and who gave orders to the army to cooperate and to help me in every way. And they did. The army was most helpful and most cooperative, first of all, in taking me round under their wings, and secondly, in trying to influence these villagers to make them accept that we give them some aid. For a whole year, well, before that, I've skipped something, the Ford Foundation were really shocked at what they had seen. Rather than run away from responsibility, as many people do when the responsibility means such a great effort, they said, we are going to show the world that under the most impossible conditions that these villages are, one can still do something for them and with them. So they voted a sum of $500,000 to be spent on pilot projects in the frontier villages, just to see how far they can be of any use, and how far, if they are successful, other people with money might come in. And I was delighted. I was very happy that they were impressed and that they had taken that vote. So when they came again to Jordan to see with whom they could work in implementing this program, they stayed a whole week, and then they came to see me again. And they said, now let us be very practical. We cannot give this money to government because we don't work like that. We can't operate direct ourselves because, again, we don't work like that. We can't give the money to foreign church groups of any kind because we don't think that we should send foreigners to the frontier villages for fear of being misunderstood. We have seen, they said, the various charitable organizations in the country on both banks, and we are not impressed that they can do what we think should be done. And therefore, we very reluctantly say that we are going back without finding a group with whom we can work. It was never my intention in the beginning to do more with the Ford Foundation except to get them interested. I had never dreamt of taking over any responsibility there. When I took them round in 1955, shortly afterwards we were destroyed here in riots of December 1955. When their program was approved in New York and they came again in the spring of 1956, I was already involved in all kinds of repairs and rebuilding of Jericho, and I was very, very busy, and all my hands were completely full, and I couldn't think of it. All I wanted was the Ford Foundation to do something for the villages, but not through us. And I said, please, I appealed to them when they said we are going back. I appealed to them, I said, please don't. Now you have won your first objective. You got New York to approve. The second will come, please. They said, no, we'll return it. We can't, we just can't. And to make a long story short, the following day they came again. And they said, there's only one thing which will make us change our mind. I said, what's that? They said that you should take over this project. And that was a terrible, difficult proposition made to me. I felt that one mustn't lose these $500,000 which have come for the frontier villages and which may develop in more and more grants from other places. At the same time, I couldn't justifiably burden ourselves, either the society or myself, with another great venture like this one while I was so deeply involved in Jericho. I begged them to think of another alternative. They said there was none. I asked them to give me a day or two to think it over. I got our committee together and I told them the position. They said, we won't tell you take it, we won't tell you refuse it. You are doing this, you are carrying this burden alone. We unfortunately can't help you either in the one or the other. It's for you to decide. And that was worse. I wanted to be ordered by the committee. And the decision which I took was the only one I could take in the circumstances. I thought something had to be done for the villages and somebody must sacrifice to do it. And I accepted the challenge and I accepted the offer. And from 1956, we have been operating in the frontier villages. The grant of $500,000 was a 5-year grant at the rate of $100,000 a year. That was over by 1960. Since then, we are still operating, but on a much smaller scale. Now, what did we do in the frontier villages? Clearly, $100,000 a year can't possibly solve their problems. But our first attack, our first objective, was to provide water to the villages who had lost their water supply. and to prevent the girls crossing the frontier at night and being shot at and being killed sometimes. And that was a very difficult proposition. But we did it. There is no village now which has no water. Those who had lost their water resources have been given through our efforts and the Ford Foundation money and other monies, alternative drinking water. Well, I should think the new ones are about 12, the new, entirely new things, and the ones that we developed, somebody who had a cistern but wasn't good enough, was also about 8 or 9. Some 20 villages who had really shortage, some who didn't have any water, have water. Now, the most of the, except in two cases, most of the water was for collecting rainwater in cisterns for drinking. This is the normal way that people of the hills, including Jerusalem, drink. We collect all our rainwater from our roofs, from our gardens, in a cistern which sometimes lasts for a couple of years. So, since it was only for drinking purposes, we did many such cisterns. But in one case, we dug a very deep well, and we put a very big capital in it, and we had to stop because we didn't have a powerful enough boring machine to carry the casings further down. And we applied to government and to point four authorities to lend us or lease us some of their machines, and we failed. Eventually, the Water Resources Department, under Mr. Fulsom, sent their machine and dug 20 feet only, and they struck the water just 20 feet below where we had reached. That was at Zeta village. And of course, they took the credit, but all the capital was ours. We didn't mind credit. We wanted water to be supplied. The second thing that we did was, wherever the village had still some land which could be reclaimed in the back of it, in the hinterland, we would help them reclaim that land by terracing, by turning it over with tractors that we sent for them. The third thing that we did was to form them in cooperative societies. Four or five villages would get together in one cooperative society, and we'd give them equipment such as a heavy tractor, not for tilling anything in the village, but for working outside the village for others and bringing money to the village. Or in one case where we built the first modern olive oil press, and that cost us £8,000, that alone. These people always dealt with olives, but they had lost their olive groves, and now they are pressing the olives of the villages of the hinterland who come to them, because it is a modern, up-to-date machine which removes the acidity and so forth from the oil. Or else we would give them poultry. We gave away scores and scores of thousands of chicken and rabbits and turkeys to these villages. And whenever I travel now, I always see white chicken or white turkeys, and I know that's ours, from ours. Or we would give away ewes and goats, by the thousands again, to villagers. In that case, we would give them to families individually, not to the village on group. Just like with the chicken, with the poultry, we would give the sheep and the goats to individual villagers according to the number of the family of that village. Incidentally, a couple of years ago, I received a letter which I cherish and keep from an unknown sender. He wrote to me something like this. He said, "You do not know me. I don't think you'll ever see me. But I just want to tell you that I am one of the people who benefited, that I belong to such a village, and that I am one of the people who benefited by your great act of giving us a red goat. I gave every family a red goat." And those red goats would produce 3 at a time, and they would give very good milk. And he said, "Now in 4 years' time, this is the 5th year, We have had milk from which we drank. We have made cheese which we sold. We have had male progeny from the goat which we sold for meat or ate. And now I have 11 she-goats, whatever you call them, and I have a small herd. I have nothing, and I am very happy. And he said, I know you won't know me, and I don't want anything from you because you have stopped operating. But I wanted you to know that I am one of those who are now happy after what you have done. These things must be always taken in the perspective of what did we do, no matter how little, how modest it sounded, compared to the nothing which they had, to them was enormous. Thirdly, we thought, since in Jericho we only have boys whom we are training, and our mission to bring about a new type of rural family where the father and the mother would have had the same background of education, we always felt that our mission in Jericho would be only half fulfilled if we didn't start a similar girls for schools for vocational training in Jericho. But there were and still are immense obstacles against that, because we don't have enough money to run and to keep the boys' school. How can we possibly start on another venture for the girls' school? And we never even tried to do it. But when we went to the frontier villages, we thought, well, perhaps now there is an opportunity of doing something for the girls. The girls will not have to come to school. They will remain in their homes. They will eat and live with their people, with their parents. But we will have a classroom in each village where we are operating, where we would have a resident teacher, and where we would teach these girls a craft, and where they are not educated, we will teach them Arabic and arithmetic and some few things which are absolutely necessary in their life. And that's what we did. We had to train teachers from the villages themselves how to train the girls in handicraft. They originally would have known something, but we had to train them in different ways. We had inspectors, lady inspectors, who would travel every day from Jerusalem to teach the teachers and to supervise the work of the girls. We had two cars every day, two station wagons every day, going to one district or another of the villages. And the result was that more than 2,000 girls, after 2 or 3 years training, got their diplomas for us in proficiency in handicraft. But what was important was not only to train them, but to see that after they are trained, they are able to get some money as income. But since they were in the village, and they were in a military zone, and they couldn't go out to get the raw material, nor to find the customers, and nobody could come to them for the same reason, we took upon ourselves to be their agents. Not only do we train them, but we scout all over the world for markets for their produce. And we find what the respective tastes of one country is as against the other. And we get orders for them, which we teach these girls how to fulfill and how to meet. And once they have done it, then we sell it for them and they get the money. Now, this isn't much. This money isn't much. At present, we are operating in 6 places. We only have 6. Out of the 111. But we have already been in the majority of these villages, 2 years or 3 years in each village, and then moving to another. We never had enough money to be in more than 20 villages or 30 villages at a time. But now, with the shortage of money, the Ford Foundation grant was long exhausted, and we are living only from hand to mouth, according to the sales that we are able to sell for these girls. So that these girls, if we sell £3,000, we can spend £3,000 per year on the girls. If we sell for £5,000, then we spend so much. And the proportion of the number of girls who benefit from it and the number of villages depends on the proportion of the sales. It's the other way around. We start by how much there is absorption of that material. We also introduced weaving by the villager, by the villagers, by the boys in these villages. So the material woven by the boys would be embroidered and worked at by the girls. We taught them making mats, making straw mats, weaving flannels and jerseys and clothes, beautiful knit clothes, and then knitting the other cross-stitch designs and so forth. At the same time, we thought of developing some of the existing villages, industries or crafts in the villages, such as the Hebron glass. Hebron itself is a frontier village, and the glass was being fabricated from thousands of years probably, and in three families, inherited from father to son as a family trade. Well, it was very limited in its imagination and its perspective, and we improved immensely their tastes and their outlook on to meet the market. It's very interesting. Again, every now and then we have to cut the number of village classes or workshops, as they are sometimes called. And on one occasion, I had to cut about 20 such villages in one stroke in the north. When I mean north, anything north of Jerusalem is called the north. And it was, at that time, it was mostly in the area of the Jenin district. And I was very sad to do it, because some of these villages had only been in operation for 18 months or 2 years, and I hadn't been to see them even. So one day, after closing down, after everything, one day I received a letter, which again I have kept. And I opened it. It had a number of signatures, names of girls, only their name, their first name, their Christian name. It ran something like that. They said, for the last 2 years, we have been hearing your name, hearing about you, wishing to meet you. And we never had this happen to us until the other day when you came. We had been told that you were not going to give us something, some good news. And in fact, you told us that you were to close down. You have closed down, but we want to tell you this, that we were blind and you opened our eyes. These were the exact words they said. Had it not been for you, we could not have written you this letter you taught us to write. We want to tell you that God be with you, and we are always grateful to you, though you will never see us again. And I have kept that as one of the most loving sort of tokens of gratitude given by anybody to anybody else. People who don't expect to see you again, who know that they can never get any help similar to what they had, who have appreciated the little effort that we gave them to enable them to write a letter, a very simple letter written by girls in there between 15 and 18, but very simple, short sentences, just to the point, and that was that. Well, these appreciations that I received from one village after the other were really my my reward for any effort or any difficulty that I may have had. The difficulty in working in these frontier villages was not only to convince them in the beginning that we had no ulterior motives, we had no desire to make them forget their rights and their lands, because that is what my critics went round to tell them, that I am working in order that they should forget what they have lost, and I would try and compensate that by giving them employment. That was a tough year for me to go through. Not only that, but not only the finding of money and finding of customers to buy what the girls were doing, But it was a physical danger for all my colleagues who worked there. Now it is not so, and people forget that in the early days until 1960, they were shooting the whole time, all along that frontier. My girls and my teachers had to take refuge and drop themselves flat on the ground, sometimes for 10, 15, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, because the bullets were coming right through around them. And I think that these girls who used to go every day of the year, winter and summer, raining or storm or anything, to these villages under these difficult circumstances, even of being shot at and being killed or wounded, I can never express sufficiently my gratitude for their courage and for their perseverance in what they did. Without them, I certainly couldn't have done it, because I only had the idea, but it was they who implemented it. And if the Frontier Village program, which we call the Rural Development Program, was a success, it was a success through the effort of these colleagues, these young ladies and friends of mine, and whom I all call as nieces, and they call me as uncle, who have done it.